Hello and welcome to the ASP podcast. The American Security Project is a non-partisan think tank looking into some of the big national security issues facing us all. Today we're joined by Matthew Wallen, a policy analyst here at ASP, specialising in public diplomacy. And our special guest, Paul Rockauer. Paul is the Director of Communications for American Voices, a non-profit that promotes cultural diplomacy to countries in transition or isolation. He's also just returned from Iraq. So welcome.
Thank you. It's nice to be here. Good to be back.
What did you do in Iraq?
I was running a performing arts academy called Youth Excellence on Stage, Yes Academy. That is the flagship program of American Voices. We do cultural diplomacy to countries emerging from conflict or isolation. We've been putting on these Yes Academies in Iraq for 6 years now. This was our sixth program in Kurdistan. This was our first time we had it in Duhok. We had 300 Iraqi students from all across Iraq, from Basra, Baghdad, and all over Kurdistan. And we were teaching them jazz and rock, hip-hop and breakdance, adult theater, children's theater, classical symphony, and piano. We brought 12 American faculty from Baylor University, from East Carolina University, University of Missouri, and we brought them there for a two-week performing arts academy in Duhok, and then we had smaller mini-programs in Kirkuk and in Baghdad.
What was the feedback you got there? I mean,
The Iraqis absolutely loved it. Students would say, we've learned more in an hour of your classes than we did in a month of our own. We've been working with these students, and so we recruit the students from fine arts institutes, from music schools. We don't teach kids to play. We teach aspiring musicians to play better. We teach aspiring cultural leaders, you know, teachers and at the fine arts institutes, how to teach better. We are really working on training the next generation of cultural leadership in Iraq and other places.
What kind of people are you bringing over from the United States to participate in this program, and roughly how many?
We bring, this program had 12 faculty from the U.S. These are mostly people who we've worked with before, who have been to our performing arts academies in Lebanon, in Syria, in Afghanistan. We brought theater professors from East Carolina University, a piano professor from Baylor University, and these are people who are quite flexible and quite good at dealing with situations that are thrown at you, like when the power goes off or when so we were having a quadrilingual performing arts academy, which meant that we had classes in English and then translated into Arabic and both dialects of Kurdish, Badini and Sirani, because Duhok is a Badini-speaking area, and most of our students were from Sirani-speaking areas. So, of course, that led to all sorts of fun when we had more Badini translators than Sirani translators and Sirani students who didn't understand Badini. So there were times where we would have to translate the class into Arabic so that the Kurdish students would understand. This was quite an endeavor running a performing arts academy in Iraq.
Wow. And, you know, let's get back to, you know, down to brass tacks. Why is this important?
It's a very good question. It's important because the level of arts infrastructure in Iraq has been neglected over the years, and so we can really help offer these students a level of training that's just not available to them, teaching them the real basics and foundations to the arts, teaching them new ways of expression, new avenues of empowerment, and really working on training the next level of next generation of Iraqi cultural leaders so that these kids can really stand out in their youth orchestras, can stand out in their classrooms, in their institutes of fine arts. We also bring American Voices scholarship students from Iraq to the U.S. Who are going to be studying in St. Louis, at St. Louis University, at East Carolina University, and we actually are proud to announce that American Voices has a new scholarship program at Baylor University to bring over piano students. And these students are really going to be running fine arts institutes and wow, performing better.
And Matthew, you've just authored a paper on the public diplomacy imperative. Why is this program and programs like this in public diplomacy, why is that important for national security?
Well, it's really about building long-term relationships with countries where either they don't exist or finding a foundation to build that over time. As you find, you generate disconnect if you're not constantly engaging these people. So if you're over there, you're introducing them to Americans, you're speaking to them on a regular basis, and you follow up with those programs afterwards, that starts the beginning of a relationship that forms over years. And a lot of these trust relationships that are so important in these regions, we've neglected in a lot of cases.
Yeah, I mean, we can see over the Arab Spring issues, and especially in Egypt, where the DoD has been saying, "Whoa, we've got these long-term relationships with military leaders." So this is what you're trying to say is this is what we're trying to create on the civilian side.
Yeah, it has to be absolutely more than just a military function. I mean, that has its uses and it's beneficial in certain ways, but building those societal relationships over the long run are much more important.
Yeah, and Paul, you're a public diplomacy specialist. You know, you've not just done this in Iraq. I mean, what else have you found within the Middle East region on these sort of issues?
Well, I think that it's really plays to the people-to-people connection when you have people there, when you have them eating together, playing, you know, music together. It really socializes a connection that you can't do via social media. You can't tweet your way to the last 3 feet. The only way you're really going to change people's attitudes is if you're there. You know, and a lot of times when we first started doing these programs in Iraq, we were the first Americans they met who weren't diplomats or military. And this is a way of showing a different side of America, showing a real connection which transcends any kind of
commonality.
Yeah, you know, the commonality and showing that, you know, one, showing, you know, the Kurds and the rest of the Iraqis, you know, showing them, bring them together because they don't often have a common space to work.
And it's impossible to falsely demonize people if you actually know them.
Right. Yeah, there's, you know, the connections you make when somebody's in front of you is far beyond anything that you can get from the television, from this. We really believe in long-term engagement. We've been running this program for 6 years in Iraq, and so we build these relationships, we build these networks. We don't think that, you know, you can have real cultural engagement if you aren't there in the trenches, if you aren't working with people so that they know who you are. They help, you know, they help you on a personal level because they know you. They know you're coming back. They know that you're invested in helping them, and it's not just, you know, a little photo op cultural diplomacy program, but that you're there year in, year out.
That brings up something that I think is really important. What is there in terms of follow-up? After you've gone and you've engaged in the program that you're in, you come back home, what happens after that?
We do use social media in that regard. We build, you know, Yes Academy pages where the kids continue to interact with us and interact with each other. We offer a lot of Skype music lessons. You'd be amazed how well you can do a music lesson on Skype. Our teachers and performers work together via Skype to continue their lessons. As I mentioned, we bring some scholarship students over, and we keep them connected. We keep the kids connected with each other because they've had this, you know, transformative experience. We keep them connected with the staff and with the faculty so that they know that the door is open, they can continue their studies. We really try and make sure that it's not just a one-off program, that it's not just something that happens once a summer, but that we continue that you know, real close connection.
And I think that also gets down to real good use of social media. Instead of just tweeting at people or talking to people you haven't met before on the internet, you actually get them together and you use that to continue that relationship after you've met them in person and develop something that's basically a personal person-to-person relationship.
Yeah, and I often think Skype is not really social media. It's more like a telephone.
Yeah. Well, yeah, absolutely.
and so where else are you working in these issues?
Yeah, well, we've done work in over 110 countries worldwide. Originally, when American Voices was founded, it was focused on Central and Eastern Europe after the, you know, after the opening of the Soviet Union. We've, over the years, focused more now on countries in conflict or isolation. We've done performing arts academies in Syria, in Lebanon. We have an annual performing arts academy. We're going to be doing one in Sudan. We've done one in Sudan in the past. We did it in the past, one in Khartoum and in Juba, dealing with social theater, with hip-hop and breakdance. We're going to be doing one in Khartoum this year, looking at breakdance and hip-hop and theater. We had a performing arts academy in Malaysia, in Borneo, the first breakdance academy in Borneo and Broadway. Yeah. Also in Penang, we had a Broadway and breakdance academy in conjunction with the Georgetown Arts Festival. It's a big cultural festival in Malaysia. We do an annual performing arts academy in Thailand, where we bring kids from across the region, from Burma, from Thailand, Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam. We brought some from India and from Iraq, from Gaza. We've done performing arts academies in Jordan, where we brought kids from across the Middle East. We work all over.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know, and I think this leads to a sort of a wider point of you know, we touched on before, is the support for not just cultural issues, but public diplomacy as a whole. And Matthew, you know, what was your take from the report you did?
Well, there seems to be sort of a lack of direction in public diplomacy. I think it really needs to be more about finding that sort of strategic purpose. That is, when you have these cultural diplomacy programs, when you have your international broadcasting, what are you really trying to do with that? And I think we discussed that a little bit earlier when we talked about building relationships that really join people together over time. And as you mentioned before, if you don't know these people, it's much easier to demonize them. So it's really about building those relationships and making that part of your strategy, essentially, to focus everything to accomplish that.
Yeah. And what are the what are the complication factors? What do you find difficult about doing this type of work?
Only a few complications. keeping the power on, making sure that there's enough instruments for the musicians, hoisting a piano up and down the stairs.
That's easy.
Yeah.
We've all done that.
Burdens.
Yeah. This was in some ways a public diplomacy summer camp. I had to bang pots and pans through the hallways to make sure that our musicians were waking up on time. In fact, the kids would ask me, what instrument do you play? And I would, you know, bang pots and pans together and they would laugh. Complications of making sure you have enough translators, making sure you have enough instruments, making sure some of the most simple things of making sure all of your students are getting fed. That was, you know, the secret to public diplomacy is sometimes the banal nitty gritty stuff of making sure that you have enough translators, you have enough food, you have, I mean, we theorize public diplomacy and cultural diplomacy, but sometimes it's really about the very practical nitty gritty stuff that matters. You can't get around it.
And so, how did you actually find Iraq? Because it's been 8-9 years since I've been there.
First off, we were in Kurdistan, in northern Kurdistan, in Duhok. It's booming. It's doing really well. New cars everywhere. Duhok has this real sense of you know, that the place is doing very well. Security situation was great. We had no problems. I felt very safe there. Really, you saw lots of tourists coming from the rest of Iraq to Duhok because the weather was better and the security situation was really good. Erbil felt quite good. Soleimani, I mean, it feels like really an oasis in Iraq. I didn't get to the rest of Iraq. I was in Kirkuk. That was a little more precarious. We had to we did this mini program in Kirkuk for jazz and rock, for piano, woodwinds, and symphony and children's theater. And we had to get ASAISH, which are the Kurdistan Regional Government Security Forces, to give us armed convoys from Erbil to Kirkuk on a daily basis. And we had to change our routes. We had to switch out of these armored convoys into small cars where we would drive 100 miles an hour through the city. And we were guarded at all times, and the building was guarded at all times. And I kind of laughed it off because I didn't think that there was anything too serious. But a week after we left, Al-Qaeda blew up the neighborhood we were in with car bombs. And thankfully, nobody we were working with was hurt, but the building had some of the windows blown out. So in Kirkuk, it's still a little precarious. There are parts that are, I'm sure, still quite precarious. But Kurdistan itself felt very safe. I felt safer there than I do in D.C. and New York at times.
No comment. Matthew, what's next for public diplomacy? What, not just for your recommendations, but also where should we be heading?
I think we need to head to some sort of strategic plan. I mean, during the Cold War, we had a very concise view of basically what we wanted to do, and that was basically to defeat the Soviet Union. It was really that sort of, battle of ideas that seems to pop up nowadays and people talk about, but that's not really what it's about. Since September 11th, we've been talking about the battle of ideas against things like radical Islam, and it's not.
We
like
don't seem to have got
the Cold
it.
War.
Yeah.
No. We haven't really found that strategic purpose, and there's nothing that's been really threatening in the way that the Soviet Union felt to us at the time. Yeah. So I think it's about repurposing what we want to do as a nation, and there's a lot of discussion about how that should go about. Some people think it's really just about explaining America better to other countries, and I don't really think that's the case. It's about not only understanding ourselves better, but understanding the foreign publics with which we're trying to communicate better, to find those common
interests.
It's
getting a two-way conversation that
Absolutely.
You're creating, Paul.
And I think part of it's going to be about enabling communication. I mean, one of the things that we found with the internet nowadays is that everybody communicates with each other on almost an equal level, which is something you weren't really able to do in the past. So how can the U.S. lend assistance to that process of enabling other people to communicate, enabling people in these countries to have a voice and to affect the societies that they live in. And I think we're going to have to come to some sort of strategic consensus on how to do that.
And I think it's very clear, from especially from our work here, that public diplomacy is not the be-all and end-all of what we need to do for our national security.
No, absolutely not. I'm a firm believer that hard power still has a place, and it provides a base for soft power to grow.
Yeah. You touch on what America wants to do. That's all about, you know, America's economy. It's about the debt burden we have.
Right. And, you know, if from a public diplomacy standpoint, we're developing relationships with people, that does create economic opportunity for America overseas.
And we need to take advantage of that through trade agreements and through treaties.
Absolutely.
In issues like that. But it also relates to how we're doing in our development issues, our weapons programs, and our links with governments, not just people.
Correct. Absolutely.
Well, thankfully, while I was in Iraq, the only hard power I had to exercise was kicking open some bathroom doors that got locked. But I would say I was greeted as a liberator.
Well, Paul, thank you very much for joining us. This has been
a
really great conversation, and we're going to take forward our work on public diplomacy in the next few weeks. Thank you very much. Thank you, Matthew.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Hello, and welcome to the ASP podcast. The American Security Project is a nonpartisan think tank looking into some of the big national security issues facing us all. Today, we're joined by Matthew Wallen, a policy analyst here at ASP, specializing in public diplomacy. And our special guest, Paul Rockauer. Paul is the Director of Communications for American Voices, a nonprofit that promotes cultural diplomacy to countries in transition or isolation. He's also just returned from Iraq. So welcome.
Thank you. It's nice to be here. Good to be back.
What did you do in Iraq?
I was running a performing arts academy called Youth Excellence on Stage, Yes Academy. That is the flagship program of American Voices. We do cultural diplomacy to countries emerging from conflict or isolation. We've been putting on these Yes Academies in Iraq for 6 years now. This was our sixth program in Kurdistan. This was our first time we had it in Duhok. We had 300 Iraqi students from all across Iraq, from Basra, Baghdad, and all over Kurdistan. And we were teaching them jazz and rock, hip-hop and breakdance, adult theater, children's theater, classical symphony, and piano. We brought 12 American faculty from Baylor University, from East Carolina University, University of Missouri, and we brought them there for a two-week performing arts academy in Duhok, and then we had smaller mini-programs in Kirkuk and in Baghdad.
What was the feedback you got there? I mean,
The Iraqis absolutely loved it. Students would say, we've learned more in an hour of your classes than we did in a month of our own. We've been working with these students, and so we recruit the students from fine arts institutes, from music schools. We don't teach kids to play. We teach aspiring musicians to play better. We teach aspiring cultural leaders, you know, teachers and at the fine arts institutes, how to teach better. We are really working on training the next generation of cultural leadership in Iraq and other places.
What kind of people are you bringing over from the United States to participate in this program, and roughly how many?
We bring, this program had 12 faculty from the U.S. These are mostly people who we've worked with before, who have been to our performing arts academies in Lebanon, in Syria, in Afghanistan. We brought theater professors from East Carolina University, a piano professor from Baylor University, and these are people who are quite flexible and quite good at dealing with situations that are thrown at you, like when the power goes off or when... So we were having a quadrilingual performing arts academy, which meant that we had classes in English and then translated into Arabic and both dialects of Kurdish, Badini and Sirani, because Duhok is a Badini-speaking area, and most of our students were from Sirani-speaking areas. So, of course, that led to all sorts of fun when we had more Badini translators than Sirani translators and Sirani students who didn't understand Badini. So there were times where we would have to translate the class into Arabic so that the Kurdish students would understand. This was quite an endeavor, running a performing arts academy in Iraq.
Wow. And, you know, let's get back to, you know, down to brass tacks. Why is this important?
It's a very good question. It's important because the level of arts infrastructure in Iraq has been neglected over the years, and so we can really help offer these students a level of training that's just not available to them, teaching them the real basics and foundations to the arts, teaching them new ways of expression, new avenues of empowerment, and really working on training the next level of next generation of Iraqi cultural leaders, so that these kids can really stand out in their youth orchestras, can stand out in their classrooms, in their institutes of fine arts. We also bring American Voices scholarship students from Iraq to the U.S. Who are going to be studying in St. Louis, at St. Louis University, at East Carolina University, and we actually are proud to announce that American Voices has a new scholarship program at Baylor University to bring over piano students. And these students are really going to be running fine arts institutes and wow, performing better.
And Matthew, You've just authored a paper on the public diplomacy imperative. Why is this program and programs like this in public diplomacy, why is that important for national security?
Well, it's really about building long-term relationships with countries where either they don't exist or finding a foundation to build that over time. As you find, you generate disconnect if you're not constantly engaging these people. So if you're over there, you're introducing them to Americans, you're speaking to them on a regular basis, and you follow up with those programs afterwards, that starts the beginning of a relationship that forms over years. And a lot of these trust relationships that are so important in these regions, we've neglected in a lot of cases.
Yeah, I mean, we can see over the Arab Spring issues, and especially in Egypt, where the DoD has been saying, "Well, we've got these long-term relationships with military leaders." So this is what you're trying to say is this is what we're trying to create on the civilian side.
Yeah, it has to be absolutely more than just a military function. I mean, that has its uses and it's beneficial in certain ways, but building those societal relationships over the long run are much more important.
Yeah, and Paul, you're a public diplomacy specialist. You know, you've not just done this in Iraq. I mean, what else have you found within the Middle East region on these sort of issues?
Well, I think that it's really plays to the people-to-people connection. When you have people there, when you have them eating together, playing, you know, music together, it really socializes a connection that you can't do via social media. You can't tweet your way to the last 3 feet. The only way you're really going to change people's attitudes is if you're there. You know, and a lot of times when we first started doing these programs in Iraq, we were the first Americans they met who weren't diplomats or military. And this is a way of showing a different side of America, showing a real connection which transcends any kind of
commonality.
Yeah, you know, the commonality and showing that, you know, one, showing, you know, the Kurds and the rest of the Iraqis, you know, showing them, bring them together because they don't often have a common space to work.
And it's impossible to falsely demonize people if you actually know them.
Right. Yeah, there's, you know, the connections you make when somebody's in front of you is far beyond anything that you can get from the television, from this. We really believe in long-term engagement. We've been running this program for 6 years in Iraq, and so we build these relationships, we build these networks. We don't think that, you know, you can have real cultural engagement if you aren't there in the trenches, if you aren't working with people so that they know who you are. They help, you know, they help you on a personal level because they know you. They know you're coming back. They know that you're invested in helping them, and it's not just, you know, a little photo op cultural diplomacy program, but that you're there year in and year out.
That brings up something that I think is really important. What is there in terms of follow up after you've gone and you've engaged in the program that you're in? You come back home. What happens after that?
We do use social media in that regard. We build Yes Academy pages where the kids continue to interact with us and interact with each other. We offer a lot of Skype music lessons. You'd be amazed how well you can do a music lesson on Skype. Our teachers and performers work together via Skype to continue their lessons. As I mentioned, we bring some scholarship students over, and we keep them connected. We keep the kids connected with each other because they've had this, you know, transformative experience. We keep them connected with the staff and with the faculty. faculty so that they know that the door is open, they can continue their studies. We really try and make sure that it's not just a one-off program, that it's not just something that happens once a summer, but that we continue that you know, real close connection.
And I think that also gets down to real good use of social media. Instead of just tweeting at people or talking to people you haven't met before on the internet, you actually get them together and you use that to continue that relationship after you've met them in person and developed something that's basically a personal person-to-person relationship.
Yeah, and I often think Skype is not really social media. It's more like a telephone.
Yeah. Well, yeah, absolutely.
and so where else are you working in these issues?
Yeah, well, we've done work in over 110 countries worldwide. Originally, when American Voices was founded, it was focused on Central and Eastern Europe after the opening of the Soviet Union. We've, over the years, focused more now on countries in conflict or isolation. We've done performing arts academies in Syria, in Lebanon. We have an annual performing arts academy. We're going to be doing one in Sudan. We've done one in Sudan in the past. We did it in the past, one in Khartoum and in Juba, dealing with social theater, with hip-hop and breakdance. We're going to be doing one in Khartoum this year, looking at breakdance and hip-hop and theater. We had a performing arts academy in Malaysia, in Borneo, the first breakdance academy in Borneo and Broadway. Yeah. Also in Penang, we had a Broadway and breakdance academy in conjunction with the Georgetown Arts Festival. It's a big cultural festival in Malaysia. We do an annual performing arts academy in Thailand, where we bring kids from across the region, from Burma, from Thailand, Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam. We brought some from India and from Iraq, from Gaza. We've done performing arts academies in Jordan, where we brought kids from across the Middle East. We work all over.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know, and I think this leads to a sort of a wider point of you know, we touched on before, is the support for not just cultural issues, but public diplomacy as a whole. And Matthew, you know, what was your take from the report you did?
Well, there seems to be sort of a lack of direction in public diplomacy. I think it really needs to be more about finding that sort of strategic purpose. That is, when you have these cultural diplomacy programs, when you have your international broadcasting, what are you really trying to do with that? And I think we discussed that a little bit earlier when we talked about building relationships that really join people together over time. And as you mentioned before, if you don't know these people, it's much easier to demonize them. So it's really about building those relationships and making that part of your strategy, essentially, to focus everything to accomplish that.
Yeah. And what are the what are the complication factors? What do you find difficult about doing this type of work?
Only a few complications. keeping the power on, making sure that there's enough instruments for the musicians, hoisting a piano up and down the stairs.
That's easy.
Yeah.
We've all done that.
Burdens.
Yeah. This was in some ways a public diplomacy summer camp. I had to bang pots and pans through the hallways to make sure that our musicians were waking up on time. In fact, the kids would ask me, "What instrument do you play?" And I would, you know, bang pots and pans together and they would laugh. Complications of making sure you have enough translators, making sure you have enough instruments, making sure some of the most simple things of making sure all of your students are getting fed. That was, you know, the secret to public diplomacy is sometimes the banal nitty gritty stuff of making sure that you have enough translators, you have enough food, you have, I mean, we theorize public diplomacy and cultural diplomacy, but sometimes it's really about the very practical nitty gritty stuff that matters. You can't get around it.
And so. How did you actually find Iraq? Because it's been 8-9 years since I've been there.
Well, first off, we were in Kurdistan, in northern Kurdistan, in Duhok. It's booming. It's doing really well. New cars everywhere. Duhok has this real sense of you know, that the place is doing very well. Security situation was great. We had no problems. I felt very safe there. Really, you saw lots of tourists coming from the rest of Iraq to Duhok because the weather was better and the security situation was really good. Erbil felt quite good. Soleimani, I mean, it feels like really an oasis in Iraq. I didn't get to the rest of Iraq. I was in Kirkuk. That was a little more precarious. We had to we did this mini program in Kirkuk for jazz and rock, for piano, woodwinds and symphony and children's theater. And we had to get ASAISH, which are the Kurdistan Regional Government Security Forces, to give us armed convoys from Erbil to Kirkuk on a daily basis. And we had to change our routes. We had to switch out of these armored convoys into small cars where we would drive 100 miles an hour through the city. And we were guarded at all times, and the building was guarded at all times. And I kind of laughed it off because I didn't think that there was anything too serious. But a week after we left, Al-Qaeda blew up the neighborhood we were in with car bombs. And thankfully, nobody we were working with was hurt, but the building had some of the windows blown out. So in Kirkuk, it's still a little precarious. There are parts that are, I'm sure, still quite precarious. But Kurdistan itself felt very safe. I felt safer there than I do in D.C. and New York at times.
No comment. Matthew, what's next for public diplomacy? What not just for your recommendations, but also where should we be heading?
I think we need to head to some sort of strategic plan. I mean, during the Cold War, we had a very concise view of basically what we wanted to do, and that was basically to defeat the Soviet Union. It was really that sort of, battle of ideas that seems to pop up nowadays and people talk about, but that's not really what it's about. Since September 11th, we've been talking about the battle of ideas against things like radical Islam, and it's not.
We
like
don't seem to have got it.
Cold War.
Yeah.
No. We haven't really found that strategic purpose, and there's nothing that's been really threatening in the way that the Soviet Union felt to us at the time. Yeah. So I think it's about repurposing what we want to do as a nation, and there's a lot of discussion about how that should go about. Some people think it's really just about explaining America better to other countries, and I don't really think that's the case. It's about not only understanding ourselves better, but understanding the foreign publics with which we're trying to communicate better, to find those common interests.
It's getting a two-way conversation that
Absolutely.
You're creating, Paul.
And I think part of it's going to be about enabling communication. I mean, one of the things that we found with the internet nowadays is that everybody communicates with each other on almost an equal level, which is something you weren't really able to do in the past. So how can the U.S. lend assistance to that process of enabling other people to communicate, enabling people in these countries to have a voice and to affect the societies that they live in? And I think we're going to have to come to some sort of strategic consensus on how to do that.
And I think it's very clear, especially from our work here, that public diplomacy is not the be-all and end-all of what we need to do for our national security.
No, absolutely not. I'm a firm believer that hard power still has a place, and it provides a base for soft power to grow.
Yeah. You touch on what America wants to do. That's all about, America's economy. It's about the debt burden we have.
Right. And, if from a public diplomacy standpoint, we're developing relationships with people, that does create economic opportunity for America overseas.
And we need to take advantage of that through trade agreements and through treaties.
Absolutely.
In issues like that. But it also relates to how we're doing in our development issues, our weapons programs and our links with the governments, not just people.
Correct. Absolutely.
Well, thankfully, while I was in Iraq, the only hard power I had to exercise was kicking open some bathroom doors that got locked. But I would say I was greeted as a liberator.
Well, Paul, thank you very much for joining us. This has been
a
really great conversation, and we're going to take forward our work on public diplomacy in the next few weeks. Thank you very much. Thank you, Matthew.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.